From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Mission District.
Fremont.
El Cerrito.
O-Town, baby.
Lake Merritt.
Coming up, who are the real first responders when a drug user overdoses?
So people tend to use drugs with other drug users. They don't use drugs with police officers and their parents, for the most part.
Then why one scientist says it's smart for the city to provide drug users with the tools they need to use drugs safely.
Fire extinguishers in your kitchen don't prevent fires, but they make it less likely that your house is going to burn down.
The concept of harm reduction. And we'll hear how some men cope with death while serving time in prison.
I counted 49 family members that I've lost. It's not even including friends and people that I've known in prison.
Coping, grieving, and staying alive today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Today is International Overdose Awareness Day. Here in the U.S., unintentional overdose deaths from prescription opioids have quadrupled since 1999, according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Opioids are a class of drugs that include pain medications like morphine or hydrocodone, as well as street drugs like heroin. Cities across the country are looking for ways to fight this increase in overdose deaths, but San Francisco has a long history of dealing with the issue. For almost a decade, an organization called the Dope Project has given drug users the power to save their own lives with an anti-overdose drug called naloxone. KLW's Mary Lee Williams tells us more.
Sign in for me right here.
What it's under?
It's syringe access night at Glide Church in San Francisco's Tenderloin District. And volunteer Kevin Smith is refilling a prescription for Jana Lee. Lee isn't her real last name. She preferred to remain anonymous. Every Tuesday, from 7 o'clock to 9, anyone can come in to get their free longs, bee stingers, and, in Lee's case, a naloxone refill. She used her last dose of the anti-overdose drug this morning to save her friend's life.
He's really cutting down on his usage, but he gets really strong stuff when he does get it, and he's been going out. Like he's been OD'ing it.
The man Lee saved this morning overdosed on heroin.
Did you end up doing any of the sternum rubs or before applying? Or?
Rubbing someone's sternum in the middle of their chest is a common way to check if someone is having an overdose or just nodding off. After trying the sternum rub, Lee realized her friend was having an overdose, and she put her naloxone to use. Rather than injecting it, she used a nasal device. She says she's not comfortable using a syringe.
I am insecure about that I'll be able to get that drawn up out of that vial in the right amount of time, in a good amount of time. That is what I'm totally afraid of.
But on Tuesday night, they'd run out of nasal injectors.
Yeah, what we have are the musclers today. And I don't know if you've seen these kits.
A muscler basically means a large syringe. And it's used to inject naloxone into the thigh muscle.
And so I'll give you up to the day. And this will
be
all right.
Glide and four other syringe access programs in the city get their supply of naloxone from the Dope Project, which stands for Drug Overdose Prevention and Education. They collaborate with the San Francisco Department of Public Health.
It's just pure public health.
Eliza Wheeler is the Dope Project's only full-time employee.
You give people this tool, you teach them how to use it, they avert a death.
The Dope Project buys the naloxone and makes sure it gets to the organizations like Glide and their volunteers, who then give it to people like Lee. They use what's called a standing order. It means a doctor only needs to write one prescription, but that prescription allows people who are trained, but not medically certified, to give out the drug. They've been doing it this way since 2010. Prior to that, a doctor or nurse practitioner had to be physically present to refill and issue naloxone prescriptions. Wheeler says this has dramatically increased the amount they can distribute.
We went from giving out naloxone for about 14 hours a month. So it was 7 2-hour sites throughout the month where you could get naloxone to, now we give out naloxone almost 200 hours a month, I think.
Wheeler points out that when it comes to overdoses, opioid users or people close to drug users are the real first responders.
So people tend to use drugs with other drug users. They don't use drugs with police officers and their parents, for the most part. Also, drug users had been witnessing overdoses and responding to overdoses for as long as there were drug overdoses.
Wheeler herself has used it several times over her 20 years of needle exchange and harm reduction work. Harm reduction is a philosophy that's about making drug use safer for those who are unable or unwilling to stop. The focus is on reducing negative consequences rather than trying to stop people or punish them for drug use. Wheeler says some people are so scared of punishment that they might not contact first responders in an overdose situation.
That's a powerful, it's powerful fear, powerful distrust of a system, you know, that is very real for people.
She's personally seen cases where an overdose is occurring, but people are too scared to call 911.
I've heard parents, like not drug users, parents afraid to call 911 for their child, would rather have their own naloxone to revive their kid who struggles with substance use than call 911 because they're just afraid of how their kid will be treated or will they be arrested, and they don't want them to go to jail.
Jana Lee didn't call 911 Tuesday morning when her friend overdosed.
Within the space of a week and a half, he's gone through three doses.
While getting her naloxone refill, Lee has to provide some information about what the anti-overdose drug was used for, who the drug was used on, and what opioids they were using. Kevin Smith, the Glide volunteer, jots down the information in a large three-ring binder.
Yeah, we're just curious, only for just sort of stats for the city.
The DOPE Project and the San Francisco Department of Public Health use this data for research on the effectiveness of the program. Between 2010 and 2015, reported overdose reversals in San Francisco increased fourfold. Though it's hard to know what this number actually means. Is it because there's just more drug usage now? Or are they just doing a better job tracking the naloxone they give out? Regardless, Wheeler says for her, there's no question the program is worth it.
I mean, to me, it's like if it costs $1 million, it would still be a cost-effective thing. But that's, I mean, we spend $1 million in this world on a whole lot less than a human life. So,
She says reversing an overdose is not just about the person whose life is saved, but it's also about the impact on the person who administered the naloxone.
Where you'll hear stories of, you know, oh, I saved someone. I can't believe I saved someone. I was like a superhero, you know. Maybe for that moment, they feel slightly less like a piece of trash, which is what the world treats them as for most of their waking hours, you know.
Jana Lee echoes this idea. She says being able to save her friend's life has definitely had an impact on her.
But, yeah. At least you know that, you know, there's a good reason for you to be on the planet still, because you can help someone else.
The emotional impact of saving someone's life hasn't been quantified or studied. But the DOPE Project isn't focused on that. It's just getting naloxone out there to the people who need it. In San Francisco, I'm Mary Lee Williams for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. The drug fentanyl has been at the center of San Francisco's recent opiate overdose outbreaks, as we heard in that story. It's a drug 100 times more potent than morphine, according to Philip Coffin. He's the director of substance abuse research at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. He studied the recent opiate overdose outbreaks in San Francisco. Coffin came by our studios, and I asked him about the policy of harm reduction, like giving opiate antidotes to drug users.
So
One would say it's just simply public health. It's the same thing that we do with any other intervention. For example, cars are really dangerous. Motor vehicle accidents are have been the leading cause of death, of accidental death or injury-related death in the United States for many, many decades, only recently surpassed by opiate-related deaths. However, we haven't responded by banning cars. Hmm. Instead, we've responded by trying to make cars safer. So we have seatbelts and we have speed limit laws, these things that kind of put some constraints on cars or make a car safer for when you do get in an accident, you're less likely to die, which would be the seatbelt. Seatbelts don't prevent accidents, right? Fire extinguishers in your kitchen don't prevent fires, but they make it less likely that your house is going to burn down. Likewise, harm reduction is about taking something that exists. We're not going to get rid of drug use altogether in society. We tried to get rid of alcohol use with prohibition, and that didn't fly so well. So we recognize that alcohol, marijuana, opiates, stimulants, these drugs are here. They're in our society. They're most likely going to be here forever or for at least the long run. And so the goal is to make these substances as less harmful to society as possible. Some of that means trying to, sometimes it means trying to prevent use or delay use or minimize use. Sometimes it means expanding treatment options so that people can stop using or reduce their use. And sometimes it means preventing more of the secondary consequences of use like HIV, hepatitis C, overdose death, and all of these other problems that can occur related to drugs.
So with your analogies with the car and the kitchen, someone listening might say, well, I have to use my car and I have to use my kitchen, but I don't have to use drugs. What would you say to that?
Well, some people have to use drugs. Mm. They've gotten themselves into, or their body or their genetics or their life or their history of personal trauma has gotten them into a situation where they have a dependency, a use disorder related to their drug use. And there's also a lot of things that we, and then to make another analogy, there's a lot of things that we don't have to do. For example, we don't have to eat donuts. And we don't have to eat sweets all of our lives. Yet when a person develops type 2 diabetes, which has a genetic component, just like addiction does, but is often caused or at least accelerated by eating lots of sugary and fatty foods over a long time in a person's life, we don't turn around and blame that person for getting diabetes. And we don't turn around and tell that person, hey, I'll treat your diabetes when you stop eating sugar. Hmm. We treat their diabetes. And even if they keep eating sugar and keep sneaking donuts, we still keep treating their diabetes and trying to prevent the heart disease, the blindness, the kidney disease, the amputations that can result from untreated diabetes.
So let's talk about one of the more popular opiates nowadays, which is fentanyl. And you've called it, I was doing some reading, and you called it one of the scarier or scariest even, I think you said, opiates on the street right now. What is it? What's fentanyl?
So fentanyl is a synthetic opiate that is around about 100 times more potent than morphine or heroin is.
100 times?
Yeah, 50 to 100 times, depending on the source you look at.
So that's something anybody who's had surgery can maybe imagine if they've had a shot of morphine. So 100 times stronger than that. And then what is the effect of fentanyl on the human body, on the brain? Can you just let us know?
So fentanyl is a opiate agonist. So it stimulates the mu opioid receptors in the brain, as well as other opioid receptors in the body, and causes basically the same things as any other opiates. Opiates are, functionally, most of them are quite similar, whether it's heroin or morphine or oxycodone or hydrocodone or hydromorphone. The brand names of these drugs are Cadian, Dilaudid, Percocet, Vicodin. Medically, it's usually administered most commonly as a patch, So when somebody has severe pain that that can't be managed with other medications and they require long-acting opioid medications, oftentimes they'll get a patch that has fentanyl in it and they'll remove that patch every 3 days. The fentanyl that we've been seeing on the street is not actually medical fentanyl that's been diverted, but instead is generally illicitly manufactured fentanyl coming from Canada, China, Mexico, and I believe there may be some emerging in locally U.S.-produced shops because it's actually not that hard to produce fentanyl.
Hmm. Well, I guess my final point, the U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said he's making the opiate abuse problem a top priority. Today is International Overdose Awareness Day, a global event to raise awareness of overdose and reduce the stigma of drug-related death. Where do we stand now in San Francisco? We've had these three outbreaks. What's happening right now?
So we haven't seen much in terms of fentanyl in the last 4 or 5 months.
Why do you think that is?
So I can only speculate. My hope is that what I'm really hoping that we avoid is a time when fentanyl contaminates heroin, if people start mixing fentanyl into heroin, because that's when things go really south. People start dying really fast, and we have a hard time getting control in it. That's what's happened on the East Coast, and I'm really hoping we don't see that here. That's what I'm scared of, and I hope doesn't happen.
That's Philip Coffin, Director of Substance Abuse Research at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. And now, a story from the San Quentin Prison Report.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
Bringing you hidden stories from life inside.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell. You see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You can hear a pin drop.
For people who are incarcerated, it can be hard to find the space to grieve a loved one's death. There's no funeral, no family or friends by your side to help ease the pain. Reporter Greg Eskridge has this story about how some men find their own ways of coping with death behind bars.
Man, I wonder who's going to be next. I wonder how many more people I'm going to lose. The thing that I like to do the most is to make sure that I always remember who they are and remember their memory. My name is George Coles Eel. I'm better known as Mesro. I've been incarcerated for nearly 10 years, and since then I've lost 17 people. I like to write down everything that makes that person great. Then next, I usually write a poem about that person, and that poem is usually full of love and compassion and full of the good things that they did in their lives. And it helps me to keep them in mind. It helps me to remember how great they were, and my life is better for having known them, because no one ever dies unless you forget them.
My name is Juan Carlos Mesa. I've been in prison for 21 years, and in that amount of time, I have lost a lot of family members. One of the traditions that I hold is when somebody passes and I get that news, I'll usually go find somebody close to me in prison, a good friend, and we'll sit there and I'll give all the good memories of what that person taught me. Maybe get some pictures out and look at those with them. And what this does is it memorializes the person I love in a good way and also makes me feel better. And also I feed that good energy to that person for when they pass on to the next life, they could take those memories with them. That's kind of a tradition that we hold. And it's helped me make it through a few passings. since I've been incarcerated.
My name is Richie Morris, and I've been in prison for 31 years. And in that time, I've lost 49 family members and countless friends and associates. I don't know the full number. What I used to do is when I would lose someone that was close to me, I would either get drunk, I'd make myself some whiskey and get drunk, or I'd shoot dope in my veins, or I'd smoke myself crazy with weed because I didn't want to deal with the pain. I didn't want to deal with the hurt.
The fact of the matter is, and those that have been in prison for a while know that we can get anything we want in here. We can get anything. You know, if I was to choose to go that direction, the difference is now I don't choose to go that direction. When I'm hurting, when I feel desperate, when I feel lonely, when I feel isolated, rather than go to my addiction or feed my addiction, I go to my music. And music is my medicine. It heals me.
I had a friend, Tim Nantel, and when he passed, I sat down and wrote the song that I'm going to do for him. It's called Till We Meet Again. Until we meet again, I remember you, good friend.
That piece was produced by Greg Eskridge. The San Quentin Prison Report is a collaboration between KALW, San Quentin Reporters, and Nigel Poor. More information is at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents.
Until we meet again, my memories I find you.
And that's all for today. Our team includes Leela Day, Olivia Henry, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Jurgen Klemm, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Our show is engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Just the way it's always been, I'll hear you in the wind until we
Blues rock guitarist Danny Click, who you're hearing now, is known for his electrifying live shows, but he's going acoustic at a show at the Throckmorton Theater in Mill Valley on Saturday. The show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hana Baba.
Can't wait till some other sunny day, 'cause I am always here. I have seen your tears, I have felt your pain. You'll get back up again.
Solid ground, 'cause we have seen the rain, we have seen